So it's a pleasure to be asked to give this talk. Yes, 40 years of women at Trinity. It doesn't seem that long, to be fair. But it's nice that we're celebrating this. And I thought I'd talk about geometry and geometric algebra because it does have some connections with Trinity, and a big connection with Trinity, which I'll tell you about. Now, apologies for the mathematicians in the audience, because I've tried not to really, and the engineers, a lot of engineers, it's not going to be hugely mathematical. So I'll kind of illustrate things more than I will give detailed maths, so the people who are not engineers will be happy. So as Nikki said, I'm in the engineering department, signal processing group, same group as Nick Kingsbury, and a fellow at Trinity. So I want to start with just saying something about geometry. So we've had over 2,000 years of geometry. So around 400 BC, the Greeks really had placed geometry above anything else. So geo means earth, metria means measuring. So we have, of course, lots of very famous Greek geometers. And you will have probably all heard that the inscription above the door of Plato's Academy read, "Let no one ignorant of geometry enter here." This is a picture of Euclid. So around 300 BC, Euclid wrote his Elements. So the 13 books of the Elements were theorems and results on Euclidean geometry. I'll say what Euclidean geometry is, a geometry of the 3D world in which we live. And this was actually used as late as the 1950s in schools, some schools, amazingly. So if anyone here was at school in the 1960s and 70s, then you probably had geometry on your math syllabus. Whereas these days, I don't think geometry is on the math syllabus at all. Most of it's been removed. So two-dimensional geometry, nothing more. Okay. So the 1600s and 1700s, a lot of geometry happened. And put my glasses on. Leonhard Euler, he lived from 1707 to 1783, noticed, it's one of the early geometric theorems, really pretty, that the three centers of a triangle always seem to lie on a line. And indeed, you can prove that they lie on a line, and that is called the Euler line. So this is lovely because, so what are these, for those of you who may not know what they are, so the circumcenter, the orthocenter is I drop a perpendicular from each vertex, and that they all coincide in a point. Circumcenter is I draw a circle containing the three vertices, and the center of that circle is, that is supposed to be green, is called the circumcenter. And the centroid, which I've marked in blue, is if I draw a line from the vertex to the midpoint of the other side, they cross in a line. And all these lie on a line which we call the Euler line. So, why am I telling you this? I'm going to just prove this to you empirically. I'm going to take this code away for a minute and I'll come back. So this is that construction. And if I, if I move this around, move my points around, you can see, I can move any vertex, you can see that the points do indeed always lie on a line. Now, let's just bring this back. This is written in JavaScript, for those of you who know something about it. This section here is just telling it what colors to draw it in. This little bit here is doing all the real-time calculations. So I'm just pointing this out because this code is written in geometric algebra. I use the same code for three dimensions, four dimensions, five dimensions, anything. It's very neat and very, very concise. So, now I want to just say, talk about another theorem, which is Desargues' theorem. As I said, the 17th and 18th centuries saw the emergence of many 2D geometric theorems. And Desargues' theorem is one of the prettiest. So if you are a mathematician who does projective geometry, or a computer vision, an engineer who does computer vision, or a computer scientist, then you might regard Gerard Desargues as the founder of projective geometry. So what it, I didn't want that there yet. So what is this? So Desargues' theorem needs a bit of explaining. So I take a point, center of perspectivity. I draw three rays out from my point, and I draw a triangle. So it touches one of the three, each vertex touches a ray and another triangle. So I've got my yellow and my green triangle. Then the line through green XZ and yellow, yellow XZ intersect in a point. The line through green XY, yellow XY intersect in a point. And the line through, which one am I missing? Green YZ and yellow YZ intersect in a point. And all those points lie on something called the axis of perspectivity. So if I go back, we'll just check that that is the case. Oh, I've opened it again. Oh, sorry. Let's go back, bring this up. Look at the code in a minute. So let me move things around a bit. So I can move things. I don't want to move them too much. Okay, so you can see that everything does indeed stay beautifully on this line. Now, let's bring the code back. This, again, is just telling it what colors to draw. This is the code that actually does all the real-time computations. So the intersection of the lines, etc. Okay, this is not too, it's not too hard to do in two dimensions, but I'll use the same code in three dimensions. Let's just close that for a minute. Okay, so 2D geometry, I mean, there are really interesting books on two-dimensional geometry, amazing theorems. Desargues' theorem is a really important theorem. And so let's take that away. But most of it is not extendable to higher dimensions. So when I want to go to three dimensions, I can't actually use the same things. I need to use, generally need to use something different. So it would be nice to have a mathematical system, which is what I'm going to talk about, that works in three dimensions and higher dimensions. And higher dimensions are very important in many fields. So let's go back again. Let's go down to 3D. Close the code off for a minute. So this is now a big sphere in the center, small sphere at the side, a circle, a line, a plane, and another plane. So I can rotate this in. And you can see things are intersecting with other things. And if I move my one of my objects, I move my sphere, then my intersection points all change. The little dots are where it intersects. I can intersect it with the bottom plane, you can see, or move it away from the bottom plane, and I can intersect, move it right over so it starts to intersect with the right-hand plane, etc. Okay, so the nice thing is, so this is, again, colouring things in. This is the code. Okay, just does a few. This is the line that intersects every object with, checks for intersections with, of whatever object there is with any other object. Okay, so I'll close that. So, what is this? So this is indeed, as Nikki had said, what I've been working on, not exclusively, but a lot of my time. It's an algebra of geometric objects. So again, I'm missing out pages and pages of maths here, but never mind. So take our 3D world. And that is a world, I'm going to say, governed by Euclidean geometry. So a world in which the distance between two points is, that's the length of the straight line between them. My underlying space is flat. My transformations are rotations, translations, dilations. And suppose I have an algebra where I don't just have scalars and vectors, but I have planes and volumes. Okay, so I have scalar, a vector, which is a directed line segment, a plane, which is, I'll write, if I have two vectors which describe my plane, I'll call it U wedge V. It's a bivector. If I have three vectors describing a volume, I'll call it U wedge V wedge W. It's a trivector. And this algebra is called Clifford algebra or geometric algebra. So the idea is that you have a mathematical system where you have all these objects and you can multiply them, add them, or operate on them. Now, this may sound a bit weird, but for those of you who know about complex numbers, you've been doing this all your life with complex numbers, because when you multiply complex numbers together, you're just keeping track of the real and the imaginary parts. So when I multiply these objects together, I'm just keeping track of all the bivectors, the trivectors, etc. Okay? But you may ask, what good does this do me? So I'll tell you soon. So since this is a lecture to celebrate 40 years of women in Trinity, let me give you some history. So the history, Hamilton, William Rowan Hamilton, in the 1860s, was at Trinity College, Dublin. He spent probably the last 8 years or so of his life trying to generalize what we knew about rotating in two dimensions to rotating in three dimensions. And what he came up with was something called the quaternions. Now, have people heard of the quaternions? Yeah, so some people will have heard of quaternions, but in fact, you know, in the whole of the Russian space satellite missions, US, any rotations were done in terms of quaternions. For a long time now, all the computer graphics routines have used, if you want to rotate your object in your space, what you do is you use quaternions. They're a very nice way of rotating. Okay, now quaternions are, it turns out, a subset of geometric algebra. So anyway, he was kind of the first one to think about these sort of things. Grassmann in the 1870s had this exterior product, like this U wedge V, which was a plane. He didn't really think about it as a plane, but he had these exterior or outer products. And they produced oriented objects. So that was a Grassmann algebra. William Clifford came along. I'll say a bit more about Clifford soon. In the 1870s, and he extended Grassmann's algebra to Clifford algebra. And he did this by adding inner products to this outer product of the Grassmann outer product. So basically, Clifford algebra was the remit of the pure mathematicians, pretty much, until about 1960. And David Hesternus was a physicist in the States, came along. He was doing his PhD at... Wheeler, as in Misner, Thorne and Wheeler. Where was Wheeler? Was he at MIT or Princeton? Princeton. Right. So he was doing his PhD with Wheeler. Thank you, Gary. I thought you would know. And He actually stumbled upon Clifford algebra himself. And that was because there are in quantum mechanics, you have Pauli matrices. And he suddenly realized that all these complicated matrices used to describe Pauli matrices could just be described by very simple elements of a Clifford algebra. So basically, David worked, I must say, almost alone for about 20 years until other people started to pick it up. David called it geometric algebra, which was, in fact, if you read Clifford's papers, what Clifford called it. It was called Clifford algebra afterwards. So, oh, don't know what happened there. Okay, so I must press the wrong button. Well, how about Clifford? Well, William Kingdon Clifford was born in 1845. He was made a Fellow of Trinity, so he was here in 1868. But by 1871, he'd actually moved to University College London. And if you believe what is written, he moved for two main reasons. The first was he really disapproved of being made to swear allegiance to the Holy Trinity. And the second was that women were not allowed into his lectures. Whereas he at UCL, his lectures were entirely open and anybody could come. So at that time, Cambridge Mathematics was still excluding women from the lectures, if you believe actually what's written down. Clifford was only 34 when he died in 1879. And partly the lack of take-up of Clifford algebra was in some senses due to his early death. He married somebody called Lucy Lane, became Lucy Clifford. And when Clifford and Lucy moved to London, they really did have a salon. They had a salon, and a lot of the famous authors of the day would go and visit William and Lucy in their London home. And there is a book which is called Such Silver Currents, written by Monty Chisholm, about their lives. And there are lots and lots of letters written between Lucy Clifford and Henry James after William Clifford's death. So she was a very interesting character, indeed. So why am I saying use geometric algebra for engineering applications? To be completely honest, I think it has more power in physics because a four-dimensional geometric algebra can do space-time, but it's extremely useful in engineering, and I'll try to persuade you of this. I think the main reason is it's a tool that unifies many areas of mathematics. And so it would save you having to learn separate areas of mathematics because you can use this one tool for many of them, if you put in the effort to learn it in the first place, which is not entirely trivial. Transformations, so rotations, translations, dilations, also inversions, if anyone has heard of those, are all performed by elements of the algebra. So instead of having a rotation matrix to rotate a vector, everything is just part of the algebra. Manipulations of objects in my 3D world are, and even 4D, are very easy to handle, as you saw from that code. Really, you know, I can write. There's a lot of algebra going on underneath, of course, but very easy to write high-level code. And makes, you know, fully complicated things straightforward. Now, I should probably say, at the time of Clifford's death, Maxwell, who was also at Trinity, had his Maxwell's equations for electromagnetism. Willard Gibbs came along and said, wow, there's this mathematical system called vector calculus. Look at Maxwell's equations in vector calculus. So the second year engineers here will know, because they've been studying vector calculus all term, that it, you know, it is a very useful system, but it is stuck in three dimensions. You cannot actually extend it. So, but it was exceedingly popular, useful, really pretty. So it was taken up. So some of what I'm going to talk about now is a 5D model for three-dimensional space. Now, you don't have to worry too much about this, and I've got no maths in it, but basically I take my normal space, which has three dimensions, and I add two more dimensions to it. And you can think of those as the origin and the point at infinity. Okay, so you don't need to worry about that. I could explain it all mathematically. Now, what you get now is that lines, planes, circles, and spheres are all objects. They're not equations. I don't write an equation down. It's an object. And rotations, translations, dilations are all the same sort of object, and we call them rotors. So if I play, this was something from about 2007. It was Rich Wareham did it for his PhD. And this is, it's a video, but it's real time. You have a number of spheres, a number of lines, you move them all around, and you in real time check the intersections. Pretty much as I was showing you on that coffee shop, which is what's it called, program. So this is all, you know, sort of almost three lines of code. Bit of making it faster is going on, of course. So I've got this five-dimensional space. I can do things in it. One thing that we have been playing around with recently, which is really useful, is taking one object to another. So you give me an object. Let me say it's x1. And another object, x2. Now, generally, I'm saying, you know, circle to circle, line segment to line segment. I can do circle to line, but let's call it the same object. And I have, say, a circle over here, a circle over there. I want a transformation that takes one to another. Now, that's not unique, but I want, when I've got lots of them, something does become unique. But let's just look at this for the time being. So what I do is I take 1 plus x2, x1. It's a proportionality factor, so I have to multiply it by something. But basically, I just do that, and I get this rotor. So I'll just show you. Let me show you this one, which is pretty. So this is an online tool anybody can access, but you do have to need to know how to write geometric algebra to okay, I had it up already. So the two black circles are my, say, x1 and x2, call them c1 and c2. Then I'd form the rotor, which takes C1 to C2, and then I just take small bits of that rotor so I can interpolate and form a smooth surface between them. So these extruded surfaces are very easy to form, very quick. We know their properties, and we've been playing around with using them for computer-aided design. One other nice feature of them is that you may be able to ray trace, render them, so light them in a computer graphics world very quickly. So I'll just bring up this one while I'm here. This is lines, so I would take one line to another, and I could interpolate and form a ruled surface between my two lines. Okay, so what kind of things are you using this for? So mostly it's a computer vision and multi-camera applications. Everybody knows a few of these applications these days. You can take a panorama on your phone, and you can tell your phone to go away and stitch it together, right? Android, iPhone apps will do this quite nicely. Street View, Google sent a car around with two cameras on to build up a crude 3D map of the streets. Motion capture, so animations. So what we do in animations, let me take that back. I clicked it twice. So what you would, the movies do, and they still do this, they have a ring of cameras. They have reflective markers on the actor. The actor will perform the task, whatever that is, and the cameras triangulate to get the 3D position of your marker. And then what you can do is with all those blue balls, which are 3D positions, you can find the best fit of the underlying skeleton. So what I'm left with is a skeleton that I can rig. So you call it rig when you put some skin on it, like Gollum. You can make it, you know, you can put anything. You can put anything you like on it. And so Andy Serkis was Gollum, and he would have all kinds of, like, he's done many things, but he would have all kinds of props in his motion capture. But Gollum, it was just him. He was crawling on the floor. You know, you also have all seen Hawkeye. Oh, I've done it again. Sorry. I've clicked twice. So Hawkeye have, so if you've ever been to Wimbledon, what you will, if you look up at the back of the stands, you see they have about 12 cameras. So the cameras point at the court and they track the ball. They track anything moving on the court, basically. Very simple. You can track moving things. So they pick out the ball and they pick out the players. So what they do is they triangulate, and I can, if I have the data, I can reconstruct a tennis match. This was Federer versus Zverev. So it's all examples of computer vision. Multi-camera applications. So what we are doing there is, if I have a point P in the world, take two cameras, and I view it in two cameras, or if I have a line in the world and view it in multiple cameras, I see lines in my image or points in my image. If I know how my cameras are rotated and translated, I can then, we call it triangulate, to get the 3D positions of my points or my lines. Okay? So, mostly, until quite recently, it was really pretty much all computer vision was done by points. Points are quite easy to get and match. So, what we've been looking at is doing it with other objects, specifically lines, to be honest, but we'd like to do it with other things. And we want to find positions and orientations of my cameras and the reconstructed objects. So, some of you may have heard of SLAM. SLAM stands for Simultaneous Localization and Mapping. So if I take a moving camera, from the image sequence, what I want to do is infer the camera track and build up a map of what's around me. Okay, that's what the SLAM stands for. Okay, so what did we, so I'll show you this just to prove we did it. Just to prove we did it, we took a drone up. Council took a long time to agree to this, but they eventually did. So we took a drone up from Great Court. This is an Inspire 2 drone with a very nice camera on the bottom. Forward camera, backward cameras, it's got side cameras, etc. Sounds like a mosquito. Small, big mosquito, and here's an example of the footage you get. So as you can see, this was taken when they were setting up for the May Ball, or when they were taking it down. I can't remember which. So you see, so you'd like to, the drone has very good, this drone has gyros, etc. on it. You pretty much, a GPS, so you know the position. But often, these cheap drones, it doesn't give you accurate position. So you can see there's lots and lots of particular lines and planes in this image. We can extract points, lines and planes. So it's a nice view of the Wren Library with the main tent in Neville's court. So we want to use these lines, planes, and points. So let's start with a simpler college. Trinity is quite hard. So Clare is a nice college, a nice simple college. So let's have a look at Clare. There it is. Basically, one court if you don't go over Queen's Road and look at Memorial Court. So while we're here, we might as well just have a look at King's. So King's is very beautiful, lots of lines, etc. So we didn't actually get permission to film King's, but we thought we'd do it anyway. And they wouldn't mind. So we've got lots of great footage, and we've got the ground truth of the drone as well, because we do have its GPS for these. But we'd like to do it without the GPS. Okay, so there's Clare. So as you see, it's just pretty much one court. I'll explain what we're doing in this project in a second. See if you can see this. Okay, so if you see those two pictures are from the drone. The drone is only about 5 meters apart there. So what we can do is we can extract lots of points from Clare in the two images. That's reasonably easy to do. But you get lots of extraneous points that don't belong to Clare at all and don't even match in the images. But then you can extract lines, and you can keep the points that only lie on the lines, and you get you're able to extract a very good wireframe of Clare. Okay, so now, what do we do? This is the bit that actually doesn't work, sorry. So it goes to the web, and it's so slow, it won't play in here, unfortunately. But anyway, you have to take my word for it, we get a reconstruction. And then, so you might be familiar with David Loggins' line drawings of Cambridge colleges. He drew every single college in Oxford and Cambridge, amazingly. And he drew Eton and Winchester and other places. So the architect's quite interested in how he drew things. So what our little project was to say, let me take, so I've got a wireframe model of Clare because I've reconstructed it. Then we go to the Loggan image and we extract lines. Reasonably easy to do. Then I say, well, if that was a photograph, I know I can move my camera around my true Clare image and I can see where it goes, where I have to put it in order to best fit those lines. So effectively, if Loggan was a camera, I know where he was taking it from. So then we can fly our drone to that position and see and overlay it and see how close they actually are. So this takes a while to come up, so let me just... Okay, so there's Clare. Now, two things here. The drone isn't in exactly the right position, but we need to fly it again. But you can sort of see now, if I take this, the front of it, the drone is not exactly right, but the front of it, some bits of it, including the front, match very well. And then the back is horrible. And then the sides are not very nice. So basically what the architects and history of art people would do was try to understand exactly how he drew this. So a lot of Loggan's drawings are perspective rectangles, and lots of the colleges aren't. But some, if you listen to some of them, some of the drawings of the colleges seem more similar to each other than others. So did Loggan do some, and did his student helpers do some? So this is quite a nice little project where we want to reconstruct the colleges, Trinity, and compare them with the Logan. Trinity, if you look at Neville's Court at the back of Great Court, it goes off at an angle. And the Logan print just has it going at a nice, sort of regular rectangle at the back. So it's quite fun. Okay.
Does Logan also have Great Court as square? Square
corners? Logan has Great Court a little bit better than, it's squarer than it is, but it's not completely square. And there's all kinds of things in the colleges, like Trinity. The Essex building, is it? The one to the left of the stairs? That was totally and utterly different. It had big bay windows in this, in the Logan print. So it's interesting to pick out where the chimneys were and where they've, why they've gone, etc. So they're the kind of things that I'm doing. I just wanted to spend a bit of time, take my watch off so I can see, I don't go over too much, on someone else's work. So this is Alan McRoby in the engineering department. And Alan and I wrote some papers together a while ago using geometric algebra, but Alan is very artistic. So Alan designed this swallowtail pavilion. If anyone went to the Chelsea Flower Show, this actually won, the Wedgwood Garden won the gold medal. And this beautiful thing was designed by Alan. So Alan, a while ago, got interested in Maxwell. So we're back to Maxwell again. Maxwell was totally amazing. He did lots of structures, as well as electromagnetism, as well as many other things. So there's a little excerpt of paper he wrote in 1864 about reciprocal figures. So this bit is dead easy to understand. So if I have my mouse. Suppose this is a structure, a truss. So these are beams. The engineers will know all about this. And I'm assuming that they're pin-jointed and there's only axial forces. Okay, so simple truss. Now, let's take this point here. Because it's an equilibrium, all the forces on that point must add up to zero because it's not going anywhere. But the forces are along the members. So if I look at this Q, I have to have it going along there. If I look at P, it has to be in that direction. If I look at R, it has to be in that direction. So this is the force triangle for that center point. And similarly, these other triangles are the force triangles for the other vertices in the truss. So that's nice. So you have a force, so you have a form and a force diagram. So Maxwell knew all about this, did great things with it. Alan got interested in this. It's pretty complicated, this, so for me to explain anyway. But he's extended it to 3D constructions with not only axial forces, but with non-pin joints which can transmit moments and members in which the forces are not only axial. So how's he done that? So he started out like this. I'll show you what this is. I've got to bring this up here. This one. Yeah. So suppose my AB. My DEBC is my form. It's my structure, and I take a point A and I draw lines down this structure. So although this is scalar, if I move A around, this number here is adding up the bivectors of all these faces. So you know what a bivector is? It's a plane, it's an oriented plane. I have an algebra, I can add them all together, I get another bivector, and it's that bivector for this face here. So that's kind of easy to show, it's well known. It's putting the standards, easy things into geometric algebra. But then Alan actually, I'll show you a little video. What Alan has done is he's said, okay, can I use these ideas? So he's using bivectors. He's going up to a higher dimensional space, four dimensional, so his bivectors can not only be, they can be bending moments and forces. So he's got this six-dimensional algebra. And he can then do, he can form reciprocal figures for very complicated structures. Now, this is pretty hard to understand. Alan calls it his Corsican sum cell. So basically, you can have, that's a structure, that's its reciprocal, and the colors and the widths of these members give you the forces and the bending moments, so you have a complete stress analysis of your structure. So Alan's been able to build up structures in equilibrium, and he knows all their properties. I've got to say, I don't fully understand this as yet, but I'm kind of working on it, and it looks very pretty. Okay, so a few other little things. What we've been doing is making some tools for the system. So at the moment, there's an IPython notebook that you can log on. Because it runs on as your notebooks, you can actually then try it without installing any of the libraries, and there's lots of help code there. It provides the complete environment. I should thank Steve and Kenick, those coffee shop, all those 2D geometry things I was doing, he owns a computer graphics company in Belgium, and he uses all this in his graphics, and he is a master programmer. Hugo, my PhD student, who did a lot of the online visualization. The package that does the geometric algebra was written by Robert Kern, Alex Arsenovich, and Hugo Hadfield, and these are some books. Rich Wareham, I showed a few of his figures. And Alan's paper is called, in the Royal Society Open Science 2017, is called The Geometry of Structural Equilibrium. That's really, really pretty. So I will, not too much of an overrun, I will leave you with this video while answering questions if you have any. And you can tell me what the video is. Yes?
Jen, thank you. Most interesting. I'm not a Trekkie myself, but I do recognize some of the things that appear on television. When I arrived in 1959, Sir John Braker had been praised for his plastic design of structures because fourth-order differential equations were difficult to solve in those days, and you didn't have much in the way of computing power to do it. Yep. Now, your geometric algebra, can you tie it in with current finite element analysis to take a curved structure like an aircraft fuselage and speed up the analysis of this and show how loads can be projected into the structure?
I think Alan can, but I'm very, not me, but I think then, so I was talking about sort of polygonal type things in those examples, but Alan extends it to curves and loops, so I think that, that would be possible.
You've got a long way to go, thank you.
Not my field.
thank you. Actually, I thought the general version of scalar and vector would be matrices and tensors. So is there any relation between matrices and phi vector?
Yeah, so we try to keep it as coordinate free as possible. So we don't use matrices and don't use tensors. So where a matrix is a, where we would have to, is if you had a linear function operating on something. And then the equivalent would be a matrix would map vectors to vectors. Something like the inertia tensor, you know, that will clearly act on something else. Yeah. So you can have tensors in our language, still linear functions, but they map vectors to bivectors or bivectors to bivectors or things like that, whichever algebra you're in. So it is all in there, but it's couched in different terms.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
Any more questions?
Stunned everybody. By the way, that's traveling in hyperbolic space. Starship Enterprise moving in hyperbolic space.
Can I ask one?
Yes.
So is there an optimum number of points? So for example, for Gollum, because your code seems very simple, right? But does your simulation get more accurate the more points you get, and what does that do to then computing
time? So in the Gollum type of stuff, you know, that is a very constrained system, and you need enough points to be able to determine the joint. So it's generally, if you've got three on each limb, and it can be less, you've got the skeleton, you've got the rotations. But in general, if I'm reconstructing things, the more lines I have and the more points I have, the better it is, because it pins down, because inevitably they're very noisy. Yeah. Yeah. And the more camera views you have.
So with that, let's thank Joan for her great speech.